Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to this lecture in the Senate Department's occasional lecture series. Australia is a very peculiar country. We have a federation in which each of the constituent states and the central government are constitutional monarchies, each with the same monarch, who is also the monarch of a country which the High Court has now said is a foreign country. A very strange arrangement. Our guest lecturer today, Dr. Anne Toomey, has written extensively about the Crown. In fact, she's just published a book, or was about to publish a book, called The Chameleon Crown, which I recommend to you. I know, I haven't seen it, but I know it'll be good. She's also written a monumental tome on the Constitution of New South Wales and a very excellent report on federalism for the New South Wales government. So she knows a great deal about this subject and will enlighten us greatly, I'm sure. Please welcome Dr. Anne Toomey.
Before the states were even formed, the battle for sovereignty had already begun. Some of the framers wanted a system akin to the Canadian one, where the Governor-General would be the senior representative of the Crown in Australia, and all communications from the states to the Crown would have to go through the Governor-General. Others sought to maintain the sovereignty of the states. The idea was to create a federal system where you had a limited federal government with limited powers, but most powers being exercised by the states that remained sovereign. In the end, it was the latter, the people who believed in state sovereignty, who prevailed. Sir Samuel Griffith, who was one of the drafters of the Constitution, made it very clear that when he used the term governor in the Commonwealth Constitution, it was intended to indicate that these were not lieutenant governors, as in Canada, but rather to show that the states were sovereign and maintained their independent links with the United Kingdom. Unlike the Canadian system, state governors were to be appointed directly by the Queen rather than the Governor-General. The proposal that communications between the state governors and the monarch be passed through the Governor-General was defeated. The result was that the federation established by the Commonwealth of Australia was one in which sovereignty was shared. Both the Commonwealth and the states were sovereign within their own spheres and within their own sets of powers. Each had an independent relationship with the Crown through the British Secretary of State for the Colonies. The Commonwealth had no say or involvement in matters such as the appointment of state governors, the reservation of state bills, or the disallowance of state laws. These were all dealt with by the monarch on the advice of British ministers. The states preferred this outcome because they regarded the British as being less politically interested in their affairs than the Commonwealth government, and therefore more likely to be fair and reasonable in their dealings. The Commonwealth, however, from the very beginning, kept trying to claw back state sovereignty and assert its dominance over the states. If it couldn't control all state communications to the Crown, it at least wanted copies of them. The British government agreed that state governments should, at their discretion, copy their communications to the Governor-General if they concerned federal matters. Now, this led to constant complaints from the Governor-General for decades that the Governor-General was not receiving copies of all the correspondence that he should have seen. In 1912, A.B. Keith, later to become a quite famous constitutional scholar, but at the time working in the Colonial Office, explained to his masters in the Colonial Office, quote, "The truth, of course, is that the Governor-General has comparatively little work to do, and is therefore naturally anxious to see as much correspondence as he can, otherwise he has very little of interest to read." The British government wasn't terribly sympathetic to these complaints from the Governor-General and basically ignored them and left the system as it was. The relationship between the Crown and its dominions changed dramatically after World War I during the 1920s. The Governor-General ceased to be a representative of the British government, and Dominion ministers were permitted to advise the monarch directly on Dominion matters, including the appointment of the Governor-General. So, for example, the appointment of Sir Isaac Isaacs as the Governor-General of Australia was directly by Commonwealth ministers advising the King. the reservation of bills and the disallowance of laws, all those matters the Dominion ministers could advise the King directly. These changes culminated in the enactment of the Statute of Westminster, 1931, which freed Dominion legislatures from the application of the Colonial Laws Validity Act, 1865, which meant that they were no longer bound by imperial laws of paramount force, except for those of constitutional status, like the Commonwealth of Australia Constitution Act. These changes, however, did not apply to the Australian states. The states are often unfairly criticised for not lobbying to be given that same legislative freedom granted by the Statute of Westminster. However, they actually had quite good reasons for not doing so. First of all, Western Australia, South Australia and Tasmania all wanted British legislative protection from Commonwealth abuse of power and to be able to seek British legislation to allow them to secede from the Commonwealth. Now, this was a serious issue in the 1930s in Western Australia at the time, but it was also, interestingly, when you go back and look at the original files, it was also a point made by the Tasmanians and the South Australians. Now, although they weren't ever seriously considering secession at that stage, they were concerned that it was part of the balance of power between them and the Commonwealth. If they could say, well, we can go and ask the United Kingdom to change legislation to protect us from you dominating us or to ultimately secede, and that's not within your power, Commonwealth, then that gave them a negotiating edge in their relationships with the Commonwealth. So that's one of the reasons the state still wanted to be under the British Crown and to be able to have British legislation applying to them. The second reason was that the Colonial Laws Validity Act was actually the source of power for entrenching state constitutions. So if you got rid of the application of the Colonial Laws Validity Act to the states, it would mean they'd no longer be able to entrench parts of their own constitution. And that also fed into serious political issues of the day about state upper houses. So you had the situation in New South Wales where you had the Conservatives wanting to entrench the existence of the appointed upper house. Then you had the Lang government coming to power and trying to abolish the upper house. And you had litigation that was going on at the time of the Statute of Westminster. It was travelling through the courts, up to the High Court and then on to the Privy Council in the Trethowan case, as to whether this was an effective measure of entrenching provisions in state constitutions. So interestingly, if you look at the New South Wales government files on the Statute of Westminster, once the time that Lang got into power, you'd think to yourself, yes, the man would jump at getting rid of the Colonial Laws Validity Act, because then he would easily be able to abolish the Legislative Council. But interestingly, his Attorney General took a more principled position and said this matter is sub judice, it's in the courts, it's inappropriate for us to seek a change to the system while the matter is in litigation, and therefore the New South Wales government didn't lobby to make that change at that stage because they thought it inappropriate to do so. There are many things one could say about the Lang government, but you know, reticence and concern for propriety is probably not something that's well known for. Thirdly, the British Parliament would only relinquish its legislative power over state matters if it no longer had executive responsibility for state matters. Now, as neither the King nor the British government was prepared to let state ministers advise the King directly about state matters, and I should say they'd already had some experience of Jack Lang trying to advise the King directly and they weren't terribly keen on it, given that they weren't prepared to let that happen, there were only two options. And one was for British ministers to be replaced by Commonwealth ministers advising the King on state matters. That was not acceptable to the states. Or the alternative was to pick up the Canadian system where the powers of the King in relation to the states would be delegated to the Governor-General and the Governor-General would make those decisions, again on the advice of Commonwealth ministers. That was not acceptable to the states. So if the states had tried to take that greater measure of legislative freedom at that stage, they would have ended up subordinated to the Commonwealth government, and that's why they didn't take that course. So the states remained under the British Crown, leaving all these arguments to arise again in the negotiation of the Australia Acts half a century later. The states continued to take comfort in the belief that the British government, being so far away and disinterested in their affairs, would simply act as a trustee to protect their interests but not to interfere in them. As Australia gained its independence, this belief became treated as a convention. Australian history books, politics books, constitutional law books all state that the British government merely acted as a, quote, channel of communication, unquote, for state advice on state matters. They also stated that it would be a breach of convention for the British government to act independently or in its own interests in advising the Crown on state matters. However, if you look at the United Kingdom government's internal governmental documents, you see a completely different understanding of what the position was. British ministers there considered that if they advised the monarch on a matter, including Australian state matters, they were responsible to the Westminster Parliament for that advice. And that's a fundamental aspect of the system of responsible government. If you advise, you are responsible for that advice, and therefore you have to give your advice independently. You can't just act as a channel of communication for somebody else. And also, because they were responsible to the Westminster Parliament for this advice, they had to take into account the interests of the British government. So that was their view, and it was a justifiable view as well. As long as state matters remained uncontroversial, this difference was not apparent. States would make recommendations as to who they wanted to be at the state governor. If that recommendation was someone who was perfectly appropriate, there was no problem. The British would also agree that person was appropriate, and the advice would be given to the monarch, the appointment would be made, and nobody would know that there was any distinction between the two views. In the 1970s, however, with the election of the Whitlam government, matters became very controversial indeed, and the cracks in this convention became chasms. The Whitlam government, upon its election, faced an interesting dilemma. On the one hand, it wanted to, quote, sweep away all colonial relics. On the other hand, it wanted to subordinate the states. Now, this led to a piecemeal approach in dealing with these matters, and the Whitlam government first sought to terminate Privy Council appeals and advisory opinions from the states. The British government, however, did not appreciate this fragmented approach. It thought if it was going to go through all this pain about this Australian business, it should do it in one go, get it over and done with. So when the Lord Chancellor, Lord Hailsham, met with Gough Whitlam on the 24th of April 1973, Lord Hailsham was quite up front and said to him, well, why don't you do a job of it? Cut the painter, he said. The formal UK record of the meeting is as follows. Mr. Whitlam said that in some respects his government did not mind the Australian states having a residual colonial status, since this helped to make clear that they were not fully sovereign. For this reason, he did not at present want to press for the abolition of the application to the states of the Colonial Laws Validity Act, since to do so might seem to increase the claim of the states to sovereignty. The British Prime Minister, Edward Heath, met Gough Whitlam the same day, and he took a personal note of their meeting, and this is what it said. I then asked him about Section 2 of the Colonial Laws Validity Act, to which he replied that he did not wish to have this repealed, certainly not before they had been able to consider legislation in Canberra to take its place. If the United Kingdom Parliament were to repeal Section 2 of the Colonial Laws Validity Act, it would only increase the actual powers of the states, and this he strongly opposed. It was only when his government had been able to take the powers away from the states that he would wish Section 2 of the Colonial Laws Validity Act to be repealed in respect of the states. And Heath continues with this comment, I refrain from commenting on this desire to retain legislation, which was not only colonial in aspect, but colonial in title. The Whitlam government also pressed for all vice-regal communications between the states and the United Kingdom to be made through the Governor-General, in effect restoring the position that it had actually been defeated in the Constitutional Convention debates in the 1890s. The next British Prime Minister, Harold Wilson, gave this proposal short shrift. replying that as long as the British government remained responsible for advising the Queen on state matters, state communications on these matters had to go through it rather than the Governor-General. The British government was not prepared to change its constitutional relationship with the states without the states' agreement. The Whitlam government had not realised that British ministers actually played a substantive role in state affairs. They thought that it was a mere formality and it would be easy just to drop this formality, but they were mistaken. At a meeting between Prime Ministers Whitlam and Wilson on the 20th of December 1974, Whitlam suggested that the Governor-General should be a postbox for state recommendations to the Queen. The British Foreign Minister, James Callaghan, who was there too, pointed out that only ministers can advise the Queen. So the consequence of this proposal would be that state ministers would be advising the Queen, albeit through the Governor-General. He said this would increase the powers of the states and increase their sovereignty. Now, as you can imagine, this thought disconcerted Mr. Whitlam quite considerably. He then changed his tune and he suggested that instead the Governor-General should take on all the powers of the British government with respect to the states, making him a viceroy. He then went on to praise his Governor-General, Sir John Kerr, saying that he was a much trusted person and that his appointment had been roundly applauded. Mr. Whitlam was not applauding for long. The British were not prepared to change the status of the states without their agreement. What was this status? Well, technically, they were, quote, colonial dependencies of the British Crown. Now, this was confirmed during the seabed controversy. In 1973, Queensland and Tasmania petitioned the Queen to refer to the Privy Council for an advisory opinion the question of who owned the seabed adjacent to the states. The states had taken a view from some odd comments in the High Court that they probably wouldn't get a particularly good run from the High Court, and they thought they'd get a better run from the Privy Council, so that's where they wanted to run the case. Now, the states claimed that they were petitioning the Queen as Queen of Tasmania and Queen of Queensland. The Whitlam government claimed that it was an Australian matter, so the Queen of Australia should decide it, and she could only be advised by Commonwealth ministers. Or Australian ministers, as he would call them. The Queen referred the position to her British ministers for advice as to whether she was Queen of Australia or Queen of the States. You can tell where she thought she really was Queen. The British Cabinet considered this issue after having got advice from constitutional law academics, Crown law officers and all sorts of different people. They concluded that Her Majesty was not Queen of each state, for the reason that state ministers could not directly advise her. And you can see there's this very close relationship going on here. If you can't advise the Queen directly, she is not Queen of the States. If you could advise the Queen directly, that would create a separate crown, a separate realm, and it would create a sort of a level of independence that would rival the Commonwealth. So this was the position where they were coming from. It concluded that the Australian states remained dependencies of the British Crown and that it was the Queen of the United Kingdom who performed functions with respect to the states on the advice of British ministers. The Queen of Australia only had powers with respect to Commonwealth matters, not state matters. So that title Queen of Australia didn't mean Queen of the whole of Australia, the whole Federation. It really just meant Queen with respect to Commonwealth level of government and Commonwealth constitutional matters, not Australian state matters. Finally, the British Cabinet concluded that Commonwealth ministers also had a right to advise her in her capacity as Queen of Australia with respect to these seabed petitions because the Commonwealth itself claimed ownership of the seabed. So it had itself an interest in this petition. So it could advise the Queen as Queen of Australia. The states could not advise the Queen directly in any capacity, and British ministers advised the Queen as Queen of the United Kingdom in relation to the state matters. Rather confusing. And then later the British Cabinet then addressed the question of, well, how should we advise the Queen given that we have this right to advise the Queen? In making its decision on how to advise the Queen, the British Cabinet accepted that the British government's own political and strategic interests should be taken into account. They were about to enter into another international convention on the law of the sea. They didn't want the Privy Council going around and making decisions about how you work out the ownership of the seabed, because that would potentially then have effects in Britain. Now, you'd have to say, well, you know, we, the British government, comply with what the Privy Council says, so they didn't want the Privy Council interfering in this. They also didn't want to upset political relations with the Commonwealth of Australia. And accordingly, they advised the Queen not to refer the petition to the Privy Council. But interestingly, they specifically stated in the Cabinet Minute that they did not regard themselves as a channel of communication for state issues, nor did they regard themselves as under an obligation to act in the best interests of the states without taking into account British interests. The British Foreign Secretary advised the Queen not to refer the petition to the Privy Council, as did Commonwealth ministers. So the Queen never faced the dilemma of whose advice she accepts. If they'd advised differently, there would have been a terrible conflict between her role as the Queen of the United Kingdom and the Queen of Australia. As it is, they gave her the same advice, and she accepted the advice of both sets of ministers. In accepting the advice of both sets of ministers, however, she did effectively reject the argument of Commonwealth ministers that they alone could advise the Queen in relation to Australian matters, including state matters. Despite that fact, the Commonwealth tried very hard to spin the impression that the Queen had accepted their entire advice, which included advice that the Queen only acted on the advice of Commonwealth ministers in relation to all state matters. And that's what they told the states in their letters, that the Queen had accepted this Australian advice and that was the end of it. And they didn't want the states told at all that the Queen had also accepted the advice of her British ministers. They even extended this to trying to get the Queen to spin for them by inserting a reference in her speech opening the Commonwealth Parliament, saying that she had accepted this advice from her Australian ministers. The speech, or a copy of the speech, was sent to the Queen's private secretary in Port Moresby on the way to Australia, and the Queen's private secretary actually changed the speech, as he stated, quote, "for the sake of truth," unquote. There were other incidents that showed that the states and the British government gave, that showed the states that the British government gave independent advice to the Queen on state matters. The British government rejected Joe Bjelke-Petersen's advice to extend the term of the Queensland governor, Sir Colin Hanna, in 1976. They seriously considered sacking Sir Colin Hanna for involving himself in local politics. Sir Colin had given a speech in October 1975 in which he criticised the fumbling ineptitude of the Whitlam government. They seriously considered sacking Sir Colin Hanna for doing that. However, ironically, it was the dismissal of the Whitlam government that actually saved him, because British officials considered that it would be very hard to sack Sir Colin Hanna for involving himself in local politics when Sir John Kerr had involved himself far more spectacularly in local Australian politics. Instead, they simply gave Sir Colin a rebuke, which I might add you will never find a copy of in the Queensland archives, because if you look there, there's a little note on the card that this dispatch was removed by Sir Colin Hanna. Fortunately, I had access to the British files. So they rebuked Sir Colin and they refused to extend his term of office. But Bjelke-Petersen later confessed to a Premier's conference that until that point he had always believed that he was the one advising the Queen about such matters, and he was surprised to learn that the British government gave its own independent advice to the Queen. In 1979, the British Foreign Secretary also threatened to advise the Queen to refuse royal assent to two New South Wales bills if they were reserved. One concerned the termination of appeals to the Privy Council from state courts. The other bill proposed that the Queen, or would require the Queen, to act on the advice of state ministers when appointing state governors. Even though the Rand government wasn't terribly sympathetic to Joby Joby Peterson and Sir Colin Hannah, the principle of what had happened in relation to Hannah had really rattled the other states, and they were very concerned about British government involvement in these matters. So they decided to legislate to require the Queen to act on state advice. In fact, they took legal advice from top counsel at the time, one Michael McHugh QC, later High Court judge, and he advised that on a legal basis there was no reason that they couldn't enact such legislation. Now, certainly that was the case on the legal basis, and if you look at his opinion, he says, and it would be unthinkable that the Queen would refuse assent to it, but it was actually the first thing that the British thought of when this matter was raised before them. British officials were concerned that if the states could advise the Queen directly, she would become the Queen of each state, and each state would become a realm of the Crown on an equal footing with the Commonwealth. They therefore argued it would unbalance the federal structure and that such action could not be taken without Commonwealth agreement. And that was one of their arguments as to why assent should be refused. Now, unfortunately, the poor Governor of New South Wales, Sir Roden Cutler, received this dispatch from the British Foreign Secretary in the morning threatening the refusal of assent if these bills were reserved. And in the afternoon, he received the Privy Council Appeals Abolition Bill, which had already passed both Houses of Parliament unanimously with cross-party support, and it landed on his desk to deal for assent. He was somewhat disconcerted as to what to do about this. He raised it with the government. Now, the Rand government rather balked at the idea of having its bill refused assent by the Queen. You can imagine politically that's not exactly a very good thing for any government. So it decided just to sit on the matter. Now, before a governor can assent, the governor normally has to receive a certificate from the Attorney General or the Solicitor General, which states whether the bill needed to be reserved or whether there was any reason that that would stop him from giving assent. This is largely a formality. What happened was that the Rand government just never gave him the certificate. So the bill, despite the fact that it had passed both Houses of Parliament, just sat in the governor's desk drawer. And it sat, and it sat. Now, the British officials, of course, were getting ready for a constitutional crisis because they were preparing to refuse assent to this bill, and they knew that then it would really become public that they were not taking state advice and they were using their own independent views. So they sat there nervously, and there are all these cables between them saying, well, we've checked for postal strikes, we can't understand why this bill hasn't yet arrived. Eventually it occurred to them that the Rand government had blinked and it wasn't coming. British diplomats in Australia later boasted that they were, quote, pursuing a policy of masterly inactivity on the matter. After many more diplomatic skirmishes and a little bit of provocation on the part of New South Wales, which kept teasing the British government that it was going to introduce these bills and go ahead with it anyway, the proposal to require the Queen to act on the advice of state ministers was eventually dropped. One British official concluded that, I quote, New South Wales authorities, who had clearly been trying to pull a fast one and were not really very surprised to be caught, simply gave in. Now, this was not true. The New South Wales government didn't give in. It just decided that trying to do this unilaterally was not going to succeed, therefore it should be done collectively. And this was the spur that moved people on to the Australia Acts and to breaking off the links between the United Kingdom and the Australian states. In the many discussions, however, between New South Wales and British officials on the issue, it was made abundantly clear that the British government would give independent advice to the Queen on reserve state bills, and that if it regarded them as unconstitutional in their own conventional sense, they would not advise the Queen to assent. And in fact, that happened with other bills as well. Some were held up for some time while the British were concerned about them. The Victorian Constitution almost met an ugly fate. The Constitution that was reenacted in 1975 had in it a provision about the rights to of the state government to minerals in the seabed off the state. And again, because of the seabed petition, the British were very sensitive about this, and what they thought was going on was that they were going to try and get the Queen to give her own royal assent to this and therefore give it imprimatur to their rights. And so this delayed the giving of assent to the Victorian Constitution for about 6 months, and the Attorney General in Victoria was saying, "Why haven't you assented? We need our constitution now." Eventually on that one, the British gave way. They said, "OK, we'll assent to it and we'll just leave that to the courts to decide," because the matter was still in the High Court in relation to the seabed. But you can see that on all of this, the British were giving independent advice to the Queen. They weren't just taking state advice. So, these events spurred the states to reach agreement on the Australia Acts to terminate the United Kingdom's role with respect to the states. However, this raised the same dilemma that had arisen in relation to the Statute of Westminster. If British ministers were no longer to advise the Queen upon state issues, who would replace them? The Fraser government argued that Commonwealth ministers should replace them. Again, this was still not acceptable to the states. Later, the Hawke government suggested that the Prime Minister act as a postbox. This time it wasn't the Governor-General as a post office, this time it was the Prime Minister as a postbox, passing on state recommendations to the Queen. This proposal was eventually agreed to by the states, albeit reluctantly, and even Buckingham Palace. However, it was killed off in a mammoth fight between the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet and the Commonwealth Attorney General's Department. PM&C won. They argued that this would mean that the Prime Minister would remain politically responsible for unpalatable state advice. Prime Minister Hawke was told that if the Queensland government, for example, wanted Sir John Kerr to be appointed as the next governor, Hawke would have to make the formal recommendation to the Queen and defend it in the Parliament. Now, this was just one bridge too far for Hawke, and that was the end of the postbox solution. The states insisted that they should advise the Queen directly on state matters. This was not acceptable to Buckingham Palace, which was concerned about the Queen receiving conflicting advice from Commonwealth and state ministers. In the end, that problem with conflicting advice was resolved, partly because of a misunderstanding. What happened was Mary Gaudron, who was the Solicitor General of New South Wales at the time, went to England for a Privy Council appeal, met with British diplomatic officers to discuss this issue. The British diplomats were using diplomat speak, fairly subtle levels of language. Anyone of you who knows Mary Gaudron will know that she's an extremely blunt and direct person. There was a complete misunderstanding between both parties as to what had been discussed and what had been understood. Mary Gaudron came back to Australia and said, well, she thought, she had been told, that the British government were prepared to accept direct advice from the states to the Crown so long as there was no possibility of conflicting advice. Now, the British government was later horrified when it discovered that that's what she thought that they'd said. They were just trying to be polite. But the effect of this was that Mary Gaudron came back, convinced the other Solicitors General that this is what had happened. So the Solicitors General decided then what they would do would be to reduce the powers of the Queen to such a small area that there couldn't be a possibility of conflicting advice, so that the Queen would only make decisions in relation to the appointment or removal of a state governor, and that would be clearly a matter for state advice only, and there could be no question of her receiving conflicting advice. So all other matters, reservation of bills and the like, were to be got rid of. Any other powers of the Queen were to be referred to the governor, so there could be no issue of conflicting advice. What happened was that once the states had done all this and convinced the Commonwealth that the British were on board as well, there were seven governments now agreed to all this. It went back to the British government, and the British governments, the British officials then said, the only grounds upon which we could object to this is if there were strong constitutional or legal objections, and we can't think of any. Which point Margaret Thatcher went up to see the Queen in Balmoral and said it would be too colonial for words for us to object to this. So at that point, the British government came on board with the Australians, and together all governments were supporting the Australia Acts. Buckingham Palace, however, was still concerned. Apart from the conflicting advice issue, they were also concerned that there was an underlying constitutional issue. They thought it would be unconstitutional for the Queen to receive advice from persons who were not ministers of an independent country. So you had to be national ministers in order to advise the Queen. You couldn't be a minister of state, of a state or a province or the like. And so that was Buckingham Palace's concern. The British Crown Law Officers responded that independence in itself was not relevant because the Dominions had started advising the monarch before they had become completely independent. But moreover, they said that in a federation, sovereignty is shared. Getting back to what Sir Samuel Griffith was saying in 1901. Sovereignty is shared. And they also noted that the state of Victoria had been treated by the British courts as an independent state for the purposes of a claim of crown immunity. Sir Anthony Ackland, who was the permanent head of the, or the Sir Humphrey Appleby, if you like, of the British Foreign Office, wrote to the Queen's private secretary, explaining that in a true federation, state ministers can just as much be ministers of the country as federal ministers. The states are not inferior in status to the Commonwealth, and state ministers are not necessarily disqualified from advising the Crown on matters within their exclusive competence. And this is what he concluded. He said, "As we see it, the relationship of Her Majesty with the government or governments of a country of which she is Queen is a matter for that country's domestic affairs. Australia as a whole is independent. When the United Kingdom bows out, the government of that independent country will comprise all Australia's governments, Commonwealth and state. In other words, independence and sovereignty will not be the prerogative solely of Commonwealth ministers." And I think that's an important thing to stress, that this is what was believed and understood at the time of the Australia Acts, was that sovereignty is not the prerogative solely of Commonwealth ministers, that sovereignty in Australia is shared between the Commonwealth and the states. Now, while the British might have finally reconciled themselves to that view, one might think that perhaps the Commonwealth might have had a different view on the matter. However, the Commonwealth government, when it agreed that the states should finally advise the Queen directly on state matters, itself had to convince Buckingham Palace that this was appropriate. Senator Gareth Evans, who was representing the Prime Minister on this matter, went to Buckingham Palace and met the Queen's private secretary and passed him a document which put the Australian government's position. And this is what it said. "The states are jealous of their sovereignty, and the Commonwealth has no wish to impinge upon it. The states are not prepared to solve one offence by committing themselves to another, that is, by handing the Australian Prime Minister the right to recommend or block appointments of state governors who, in the states, exercise significant constitutional authority. Any such solution would run counter to the nature and history of federation in Australia, as shown by the express provisions of the Commonwealth Constitution, continuing the constitutions and residual sovereign powers of each state." So there you have a Commonwealth minister asserting the sovereign powers of each state. The formal advice to the Queen from Prime Minister Hawke also stressed the nature of the federal system and recognised the importance of maintaining the sovereign identities and powers of the states within their constitutional limits. He concluded that it was therefore necessary for the states to advise the Queen directly. Section 7 of the Australia Acts now gives the states the power to advise the Queen directly on state matters. The same power that was regarded by the Whitlam government as dangerously increasing the status of the states and was regarded by the British government as creating independent realms and crowns. The states not only had a victory in maintaining their own sovereign status and independent relationship with the Crown, more important was Section 15 of the Australia Acts, which secured their place in Australia's overall sovereignty. The original source of the Commonwealth Constitution was the sovereignty of the Westminster Parliament. The Commonwealth Constitution was legally binding originally because it was a British law of paramount force. British legislative sovereignty over Australia was diminished by the Statute of Westminster in 1931 and was finally terminated by the Australia Acts. The power to amend or repeal those fundamental statutes that form our Constitution, the Commonwealth of Australia Constitution Act, the Statute of Westminster and the Australia Acts, given that the British government or the British Parliament could no longer amend or repeal them, where was that power transferred to? It was transferred by Section 15 of the UK version of the Australia Acts, not to the Commonwealth itself, but collectively to the Commonwealth and the states through their parliaments. So if all the state parliaments request the Commonwealth Parliament to do so, it can now amend or repeal those foundational constitutional documents. This is the ultimate recognition that no matter how much our federal system is trammelled and distorted by Commonwealth laws or financial pressure or High Court decisions, ultimately, sovereignty in Australia remains vested collectively in the Commonwealth and the states. Thank you.
Well, interesting and entertaining as well. We have some time for some questions. Could I ask any questioners to go to the microphones? Questions should be brief and should be framed as questions.
My question is, you cannot leave us with a puzzle. And as I was trying to get through your wonderful exposition, I thought to myself, what about a citizen? Do you think a citizen just might say, I've got an answer and I'll build on it? Would you answer that, madam?
Is that a question?
I think many citizens would have many answers to different questions. I think the one thing that comes from all this, when I've talked about sovereignty lying collectively with the Commonwealth and the states, I don't want to discount from that the role of the people. Ultimately, it is the people that form the states and form the Commonwealth that have a role in through Section 128 of the Constitution in changing and amending the Constitution, that have a role in electing their state and Commonwealth parliaments. So all these, the vesting of sovereignty in Australia, even though it might take into account or to be done in a way that involves the people collected in their states and the people collected as a Commonwealth, so to take into account the different roles, ultimately everything comes back to the people and everything comes back to the role of individual citizens.
Now we have a questioner in the upper gallery.
Yes, thank you. That last point which our speaker made about what the British version of the Australia Act said, what did the Australian version of the Australia Act say on that particular point?
That's a very good question. They are in fact identical in substance, and the reason why I said the British version did that rather than the Australian version, although the words in them are the same, the power to do that was effectively vested in the British version. Now, one of the things with the Australia Acts is that there was quite a significant disagreement within Australia as to whether it should be done independently in Australia without any involvement of the United Kingdom. That was the view of the Commonwealth, and that was also the view of New South Wales after just having had its fingers burnt over the whole business with the British Foreign Secretary. So New South Wales and the Commonwealth are very strongly of the view that this should only be done in Australia by Australians, no British involvement. Other states, Queensland and Western Australia in particular, thought that the British should also be involved, because if you're trying to transform sovereignty, if you're trying to limit the powers in the UK, you need the involvement of the UK in abdicating their power and passing it on. So to make sure that everything was done neatly, constitutionally correctly, couldn't be challenged and result in lots of nasty litigation, the deal was that they would do identical acts, so that those who believe that only the Australian version should count can believe that and ignore the British version. Those who believe that the British version was necessary can say, well, that works even if the Commonwealth doesn't. Now, there are some disputes between constitutional scholars. People have different views as to what is necessary and what is done, but to the extent that there is a provision that vests control in Australia over documents that were previously exclusively in control of the UK, then it is a UK power that's needed to transfer them, to vest them and to move them. And so once that happened, once Section 15 of the Australia Act, the British version of the Australia Act, passed that over, at that point the United Kingdom stopped being involved in our system. Now, the United Kingdom could repeal the UK version of the Australia Act. It wouldn't make one iota of difference, because what's happened now is that all power has passed here, and even if the British, legally under their constitution, under their powers, could say that they reclaimed power, that would be irrelevant for us, because all power is now vested here. Our courts would always recognise that all power is now vested here. The United Kingdom power is now completely irrelevant to us, but it was necessary to have that act of transferring it across.
Any other questions?
You focused very much on the historical past. I wonder whether you would comment on some of the implications for the future. For example, if Australia became a republic by a referendum at the federal level, how would you see your argument playing out in relation to the states? Would it be open to each of the states individually to decide whether it remained a monarchy? Or do you see the situation differently?
That's a terrific question, actually, and it's a very difficult one. It's one I try to address in the book, The Chameleon Crown, which, by the way, is out there if anyone wants to buy it. And I also have some flyers for it, which I'll leave on the desk here if anyone's interested. The question here, and this is one that the British addressed but the Australians didn't, is, well, what did the Australia Acts do? Was the fact that the states now advise the Queen directly, did that create a separate crown in relation to each state? Are there now separate realms? So do we have seven crowns in Australia, one Queen of Australia for the Commonwealth level and a Queen separately for every state? Or did it somehow transform that crown of Australia so that the Queen of Australia is now changed, and so instead of just being Queen in relation to the Commonwealth level, she has now become Queen in relation to the whole of Australia, but is now just advised separately by different ministers according to Australia's internal system? Now, that's something that the British were prepared to face head on. They raised it in their own discussions, and so one of their officers went to Australia and discussed this with Commonwealth and state ministers and said, well, what is it you're trying to do? And he came back and said, well, there are obvious differences of opinions out there and no one's prepared to address the question. Basically, it was swept under the carpet because nobody wanted to face that fight. They had enough difficulty getting agreement as to the terms of the Australia Acts. They didn't want to get into this idea as to whether there was one crown or seven crowns because they didn't want to have the fight and therefore destroy the agreement that they already had. So at the Australia level, it was just ignored. If you look at the Australia Acts, there's no reference to the Queen of Australia or anything else. It's just the Queen, and you interpret it as you wish. Interestingly, if you tried to apply normal rules of statutory interpretation, you end up in a very bizarre position because the Commonwealth Interpretation Act would apply to the Commonwealth version and the UK's Australia Act would apply to the UK version, and of course they refer to different queens, so that in itself is just a complete mess. One has to assume that there was some overall intention. What the British said in the end was, well, look, on the basis of history, on the basis of the whole history that I've recounted, normally you would say that separate crowns were created because state ministers were advising the Queen directly. But the British are very pragmatic in their constitution making, and they said, well, look, you could devise for Australia a separate system. So you could say, yes, you have now transformed the Queen of Australia, so you have one Queen of Australia and you have her advised by different ministers because it's a federation. So basically you can make what you want of it, was their view. And that's how it was left. So ultimately it's up to Australians in a way to decide. It's a matter of trying to achieve some sort of consensus as to what it is that was created. Now that leads to all sorts of difficulties when you come to a republic, because if you're not absolutely sure what you've got, you don't know quite how to change it. So if you've only got one queen and you get rid of her, then automatically there is no queen in relation to each state, unless you actually had a republic referendum that had the effect of abolishing one queen and creating six, which would just seem a little bit silly. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is to say that states retained their connections to the Queen, that there were separate crowns and that each state was left to deal with it. Now, at the 1999 referendum, that was the view that was taken, that, you know, each state would be able to retain its own crown and break up relationships later. But I think it's something that needs a lot more thought and a bit of consensus building.
And what is your own view?
Well, look, Harry, I tried to address this too in a PhD thesis I had. I think if one wants to take analogies from it, one should be able to say that, look, if sovereignty was vested collectively in the Commonwealth and the states, and that's what Section 15 did of the Australia Acts, then by analogy you would say that the crown then is a collective crown of the Commonwealth and the states, and it's one crown. And I think you can make a good argument for that. But ultimately, I think this is a thing that not for me to decide, but it's something for everyone to decide, and I just don't have a final view on it.
Now, we have a queue forming down here. First questioner.
Before I ask my question, if it's okay, I might cross-check my understanding of the issue. My understanding is that when the Prime Minister goes in to the Governor-General to get the writs issued for a general election, that then passes on to the governors, state governors, who then also have to agree to a general election being called. So there is a sort of check and balance and, in a way, a sovereignty there. That was an issue around the Whitlam dismissal. And with the enactment of the Australia Act, has that power changed, and what would that mean in relation to the previous gentleman's question about a republic? Would states, if we move to being a republic, give up that check and balance and power?
Oh, well, that lots of very complicated questions here today, Harry.
I didn't plant them.
No, well, there are some complicating factors in all of this. When the Prime Minister seeks to call a general election, if he's just seeking to call a general election in relation to the House of Representatives, and that's a matter between the Prime Minister and the Governor-General, if a half-Senate election is also to be called at the same time, which is what normally happens, then it's the state governors, you're quite right, who issue the writs in relation to that. Normally there's a communication to the states, and state governors are asked to issue a writ. There can be complicating factors if state laws about Senate elections and issuing the writs of them aren't consistent with Commonwealth laws, and there may be some timing problems that come up. In the 1975 period, there was an issue as to whether if Mr. Whitlam in the dying days, or in November 1975, had called a half-Senate election, there was some question that some state premiers might have advised their governors not to issue the writs for the election. Now, in my research, I've written a bit about this because the British government was quite aware that this was a problem. Now, interestingly, at the time, they said there was a rumour going around that what would happen is that Mr. Whitlam would advise the Queen, as Queen of Australia, to instruct the state governors to issue the writs. Now, again, that was a misunderstanding of the different status of the Queen in relation to the Commonwealth and the states, because it was not the Queen of Australia who could instruct the state governors, it was the Queen of the United Kingdom who could instruct the state governors. So really what he would be trying to do was Mr. Whitlam would be advising the Queen of Australia and somehow get the Queen of Australia to advise the Queen of the United Kingdom to get the Queen of the United Kingdom to advise the governors to issue the writs. The British government was quite aware of this problem and was very concerned about it. So in the lead up to the dismissal, that was the thing that was worrying, was spooking the British government. And Sir Roden Cutler had actually advised the British High Commissioner that if he was instructed by the Queen to issue the writs against the advice of his state premier, he would resign. So that was going to be a big constitutional crisis if it happened. In fact, instead we got a different constitutional crisis. Now, how does that differ now if we just have one Queen of Australia? If the same situation arose again with a state premier advising the governor not to issue the writs to an election, could the Commonwealth Prime Minister advise the Queen as Queen of Australia to instruct the state governors to do so, if ultimately that was your question? That would in part depend upon whether we have one hybrid crown or whether we have separate crowns, to which we don't know the answer. But ultimately, it's probably irrelevant because Section 7 of the Australia Acts doesn't give the Queen that power anymore. The Queen only has power in relation to the appointment and removal of the governor. So unless the Queen were to say to the governor, you know, I will remove you unless you issue the writs, it wouldn't be within her power. And again, the Queen could only be advised on appointing and removing the governor by the state premier. So it's not going to happen. There is no jurisdictional power for a Commonwealth Prime Minister to advise the Queen of Australia to instruct state governors to issue writs. Not that I think any of this is actually going to happen, but theoretically that's the answer.
Well, you never know. Now you've got your question, or you've used your question.
So a state governor could still stop a half a Senate election if they...
Technically, a state premier could advise the governor not to issue writs for that particular state for a half-Senate election, yes, but the constitution would require that half-Senate election occur by the time that, you know, the period is up, so before the period is over. So it could delay a half-Senate election, technically. Realistically, it's not going to happen, but technically, yes.
Do you know something that we don't? Okay, last question.
Thank you. The flyer that came around for your lecture, did it say Crown, States and Territories? Did I remember rightly? I didn't bring it with me.
No, I'm not sure whether territories were mentioned.
Was it on it?
Don't think so.
States, no. The Commonwealth and the Crown, battle for the sovereignty.
Oh, just
States,
Commonwealth and the Crown.
Yes.
Well, okay, I still want to bring up the territories. We
Indeed.
Are in one. The very fact that we are people again in the territories and we don't appear to have the same rights as the states, is it to do with the amount of people or what? Why can't we get the same? We do need it. There's been several variations where the states have overturned things, as you know, particularly euthanasia, which people want the choice of. So why is it the states are the poor relation? Does that make a question for you?
That's quite interesting. In terms of the Australia Act itself, as a matter of interest, there is a definition in there that makes the Australia Act extend to states and to new states. Now, that was put in at the request of the Northern Territory because the Northern Territory is anticipating becoming a state and therefore wanting the Australia Act to apply to it. And, in fact, there are all sorts of fascinatingly technical constitutional issues that arise in relation to that, which I won't go into, but if anyone's interested, Public Law Review, latest edition, I've written an article about it, about the Northern Territory, the Australia Acts and how all this could connect in relation to statehood. ACT is a different position. ACT is different because it contains the capital. There are provisions in the Constitution expressly for the formation of a territory, which is to be the place of government in which the capital is to be placed. There are special powers in the Constitution that deal with this, quote, seat of government. No one's ever been exactly sure what the seat is and where it is, but I'm pretty sure we're in it now. How far the seat extends, we're not absolutely sure. So that leaves the ACT in an awkward position. Could the ACT itself ever become a state? The answer is probably no, unless you carved off everything but the seat of government and turned that into a state, but that would be pretty awkward. It happens in most federal countries that the idea is that the capital should be in a territory of its own outside the system of states and federations. So there are sort of broader political reasons for that. Northern Territory is a different category. Yes, it technically could become a state. The conditions on which it would become a state would be a matter for some debate. It doesn't have to come in on the same conditions as every other state, so you wouldn't have to give it the same number of senators and the like. The Constitution... the difficulty with becoming a state is that all sorts of responsibilities are then incurred by you, and it's very difficult if you have a small population and not enough critical mass to be able to manage a government to do those sorts of things. But the Northern Territory is certainly trying to head towards statehood and deal with those issues. ACT is in a bit more of an awkward position, but it is privileged also to have the capital and to have much greater access to members of parliament than many other people do.
I've agreed to one last quick question. Purely on the basis of personal favouritism.
Thanks, Harry. First of all, congratulations on bringing to life what could be a very flattish subject for some of us. Has the appointment of Australian-born and Australian citizens as governors and as governor-generals change the situation and the relationships between the UK and Australia?
I think it has to some extent. There was a fair battle over it, although it, from the time Sir Isaac Isaacs was appointed in 1930-odd, Australians were able to be Governor-General of Australia. At the state level, that wasn't accepted until after World War II, so we didn't get an Australian as a state governor until, I think, 1946. And even then, that was a fairly mighty battle. And the reason for that was that, from the British point of view, the King took the view that he wanted to personally know his representative, and because it was a representative of the King. And there was an objection, particularly at the appointment of Sir Isaac Isaacs. One of the objections of the King at the time was that he was not personally known to him, and so he wanted to have there as his representative somebody that he knew. So how does that change and shape Australia? I think it does make a big difference. And there was a long campaign for that. You might be aware that, you know, in Western Australia there was a long period in which they didn't have a state governor. They just relied on their lieutenant governor, partly because of that issue of Britishness, but actually more because of the Depression, and you got to pay a lieutenant governor half what you had to pay a governor. And that was the main reason for that. But I think that in terms of the role of the governor, if the role of the governor or the governor general is to represent ourselves, it's something that would be a real challenge for a British person to do. And I think it's something more successfully achieved by Australian appointments.
Okay, unfortunately, our time is up. Please join me in thanking our lecturer for a very stimulating lecture. Well, you held the audience anyway.